We will begin and end today at the White House. In between, there's going to be aluminum, healthcare, and Wall Street, the way one woman saw it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Wednesday, the 15th of February. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Depending on how you look at it, the political economy news of the day could play two ways. Way one is that CKE Restaurants, the parent company of Carl's Jr. and Hardee's, is not going to need to look for a new CEO. Way two is that President Trump is going to have to find a new person to be his labor secretary. Andy Puzder, the nominee and the CEO, announced today that he is withdrawing his nomination. Marketplace's Andy Euler has been on the story for us. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Kai.
Puzder's been under fire for a while. This is not a total surprise.
That's right. The confirmation was looking like, you know, it was supposed to happen on Thursday, but it was looking like it was going to be an uphill battle. Yeah. But we got news that he had hired an undocumented worker. That was giving him heat from the conservatives were actually kind of worried about that because, you know, being squishy on immigration policy is tough for conservatives. Even before that, Democrats had said that he wasn't necessarily going to be an advocate for workers. Mm-hmm. He'd been outspoken about federal minimum wage increases, and he didn't want those to happen. He was the CEO of a fast food chain. Right. And so they had sort of attacked him on that.
And then, you know, in the last couple of days as well, the reporting by Politico and Oprah Winfrey being involved, the videotape of his former wife and allegations of domestic abuse.
Right, exactly. These stories were just sort of piling up for Puzder. So it didn't look like this was, like I said, it wasn't going to be sort of a cakewalk, this confirmation hearing that was supposed to happen on Thursday. It made sense, I guess, for this withdrawal.
Andy Euler on the Andy Puzder story for us. And the White House now starts, I guess, looking for a new nominee?
That's the thing, is that we don't really know. The White House hasn't come out and said anything about it. But they got to hurry. I mean, there had been delays for this.
Sure. Four times.
Exactly.
Delay, right.
And so the White House has to get a labor secretary in there.
Andy Euler, thanks, Andy.
You got it, Kai.
President Trump is hitting the road this weekend. He's going to do a big campaign-style rally in Florida and on his way on Friday, to be specific. He's going to swing by a Boeing factory in South Carolina, where he is expected to sing the virtues and the praises of the not all that long ago in the GOP doghouse Export-Import Bank of the United States. Boeing, it just so happens, is a big fan of the Ex-Im Bank. It does export promotion, basically, loan guarantees and financing, so overseas buyers can buy American stuff. Republicans have worked hard to kill the bank, very hard, which gets us to this very interesting presidential lifeline. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more on that.
David Eichert runs Air Tractor. It makes crop dusting planes and firefighting planes.
Our market is throughout the world.
In some parts of the world, the financial infrastructure is not that mature, he says.
The banking infrastructure just doesn't facilitate 5-year, 6-year, 7-year loans for a piece of equipment like an airplane.
So the Ex-Im Bank steps in with loans or loan guarantees to help Eichert help his customers buy his planes.
It's worked extremely well for us, and it is an absolute must in some places.
Now, the biggest beneficiaries of the Ex-Im Bank historically have been large companies like Boeing and GE, and this bothers free market conservatives in particular.
It amounts to corporate welfare.
Véronique de Rougy is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center. She says that foreign customers who get helped out by the bank are sometimes competitors to U.S. companies. So if Boeing gets help selling airplanes to Air Emirates, for example, Emirates gets a leg up on Delta.
It's fundamentally unfair.
This may be true in a few industries, says Ted Alden with the Council on Foreign Relations, but
if you look at U.S. export performance, generally it's so weak, I think there's a strong argument to be made for boosting export performance.
Finally, supporters of the bank say it levels the playing field internationally. Lauren Thompson is COO of the Lexington Institute.
If we eliminated Ex-Im Bank, the United States would be the only major trader that didn't have one.
And that is why it's likely Trump will come out in support of the bank. It promotes exports. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
I've said on more than one occasion on this radio program that inflation in this economy is dead. Turns out it was only mostly dead, which Princess Bride fans know is slightly alive. We learned this morning the consumer price index inflation at the retail level rose 2.5% the past 12 months. That is music to the ears of many in this economy looking for a healthy rate of price increases. Chief among those ears being the ones belonging to Fed Chair Janet Yellen. Think interest rates, y'all. Wall Street today, stocks keep on going up. I've got a theory about that. By the way, details, numbers, you know the drill. Steel gets all the glory, but aluminum is one of the industries that built this country, too. You know, well-paid manufacturing jobs for generations of workers. But aluminum, along with a lot of other industries, got the short end of the globalization stick, especially in the past decade, as China flooded the aluminum market with cheap product, driving prices down and making it hard for American companies to compete in a global economy. So today and tomorrow, we're going to take a look at two communities in the United States, one in central Washington state, another in far upstate New York, hit hard by that market shift. Alcoa, the global metals conglomerate, has been downsizing its aluminum smelting operation. So first, today, Massena, New York, where the state has ponied up financial incentives to save hundreds of jobs. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Massena, New York, is a gritty factory town along the St. Lawrence River with a hydroelectric dam and lots of vacant industrial land. Back on November 2, 2015, this was what folks heard on the local news.
Alcoa says it will close its smelting facility in Massena
and lay off about 500 aluminum workers, making $65,000 or more a year, with health benefits and a union pension plan. The company was cutting U.S. production as it faced rock-bottom aluminum prices. Bob Smith, president of the local steelworkers union, had just made the first mortgage payment on his family's new house. He was installing the furnace and found himself
in the crawl space, looking down and just seeing the tears hitting the ground. You know, so that's what we went through.
Aluminum smelting started here in the early 1900s and boomed in the post-war years.
This is aluminum. Aluminum for our industries and aluminum for our homes.
Massena's factories ran hot right into the early 1980s. 10,000 or more skilled manufacturing workers making aluminum for Alcoa and Reynolds, cars for GM. Then in 2008, GM shut down. Alcoa downsized. But shortly after news of its final layoff in November 2015, word of a reprieve.
We have really, really great news for you today.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced a $73 million incentive package for Alcoa to keep the plant open and 600 jobs in place until at least March of 2019. But decades of job loss, plant closures, and falling family incomes have taken their toll. Even with the deal to keep the last big factory in town from shutting down, local unemployment remains above 6%, among the worst in the state. Here's union aluminum worker David LeClaire.
You can't drive a street in this town without seeing a house or two for sale, if not run down. The drugs have moved in.
Aaron Covell is a guidance counselor at Massena Central High. With the American Federation of Teachers, she organized a People Over Profits rally to pressure Alcoa. She sees the result of deindustrialization as well-paid jobs for high school graduates disappear.
We have started helping students with food and clothing and shelter for not just the student, but for their entire family.
Main Street has a lot of boarded-up storefronts. Only a few restaurants and shops are open. There are economic development plans for the riverfront, which is a good start, says Karen St. Hilaire, a former county administrator and business professor. And how about those taxpayer subsidies to keep Alcoa and its jobs in Massena?
It's outrageous, and it makes no economic sense. It's more money than any of those people working there make.
Do the math. It's more than $100,000 per job.
However, I'm totally glad that it happened, because it at least buys us 3 years to do something else.
That something else is economic diversification. St. Hilaire convened a Facebook group to promote innovation in local agriculture, education, small business investment. At the local hockey arena, packed on a Friday night, there's still a strong civic spirit for the Massena High Red Raiders. Jim Heide, the former mayor and a retired GM worker, is a big fan.
Hockey's tremendous up here. Just keeps the community together.
Heide supported Donald Trump in November.
I felt that we needed a businessman running the business.
I met union guys in town who didn't vote for Trump, but like Heide, do hope the president will make well-paid industrial jobs a priority.
When you get the industries back here, when you get fair trade agreements, middle-class America will benefit.
Alcoa has not committed to keeping the smelter open after its financial deal with the state expires in 2019. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Mitchell's going to take us to Wenatchee, Washington, where the state and its finances stayed away from those jobs, but the city is doing better than you might think. All right, so you go to the fridge, you pull out some, I don't know, chicken. It's got an expiration date of, say, 3 days ago. What are you going to do? You're going to roll the dice and use it, or are you going to chuck it? Americans, the U.S. Department of Agriculture says, waste 30 to 40% of the food that we buy. Because what are you going to do? Ignore the expiration date? Maybe, a couple of groups said today, you ought to. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
Dennis Hopper from 90s blockbuster Speed? Start us off.
Pop quiz, hotshot.
There's milk in your fridge, and the date on its label says yesterday.
What do you do? What do you do?
Well, Chip Threlkeld, random person I stopped in Los Angeles, says...
Throw it away. Depends on what it is, though. Meat, I don't mess with.
Better to be safe, right? Dana Gunders is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
People are throwing food away when they don't need to be because they think those dates are telling them that food is unsafe.
Rather than, in many cases, simply not at peak quality. Labels are largely unregulated, which is why you'll see so many different phrases.
Sell by, enjoy by, delicious if used by, and they get even more creative from there.
Creative, but confusing. Now, major food retail and manufacturing groups are adopting new guidelines that recommend either best if used by or use by. Megan Stas is with the Grocery Manufacturers Association.
By streamlining down to just two, one for quality and then one for safety, we can help consumers save money and reduce waste at home.
The guidelines are just voluntary and could vary state by state. Still, Stas says there's a lot of industry support. They're aiming for wide adoption by next summer. In the meantime, you can always do what Rachel Tucker, another L.A. resident, does.
Look at the food itself. If it looks good and it's not too expired, I'll eat it.
Sniff test may work, too, if you're brave. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So I took it, I crumpled it up, I threw it away and said, these guys are not getting rid of me.
Wall Street back when it was more of a boys' club, I guess. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 107 today, a half percent, 20,611 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 36 points, about 0.6%, 58.19. The S&P 500 climbed 11 points, a half percent, 23.49 there. Bank shares have been on a roll since the inauguration of President Trump, actually since Election Day. Bank of America ended things up 0.2% today. The rally continued for Goldman Sachs, far and away the biggest winner among the banks, 0.4% to the good today. JPMorgan Chase closed up 0.1%. Persistence may prove to be the key for Verizon in its bid to buy Yahoo's core internet business. Verizon has been leaning on Yahoo to change the deal to reflect two big hacks we've all heard about. Looks like they'll get about a $300 million discount. Verizon off 0.3% today. Yahoo up 1.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Republicans in Congress want to bring an end to the Affordable Care Act. They're just not sure exactly how, and Congress being Congress, it's going to take a while. President Trump, though, has executive powers he can wield, and he is, starting with the idea that the enforcement mechanism in Obamacare, the individual mandate, is, if you remember, technically a tax. Our healthcare correspondent, Dan Gorenstein, is here to explain. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Kai.
So this is now the Internal Revenue Service we're talking about here, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, look, remember when Donald Trump took office, he signed an executive order immediately, and he sent a message to the administration saying he wanted to, quote, minimize the economic burden mm-hmm. on people. Mm-hmm. And I think the IRS apparently has interpreted that in a particular way. And what the IRS had been planning to do this year, Kai, is that they were going to reject these returns if people didn't say, hey, I've got insurance. Now the IRS is rolling back off of that, and that's seen as potentially a way to kind of weaken the individual mandate that requires everybody to have insurance.
Sure. There's also something in this, though, about health insurers, right, and trying to give them a little bit of market predictability, I guess?
Yeah, totally. The word du jour today is market stabilization, Kai. Yes. So what we're talking about here is that the Trump administration has proposed a series of rules that really will do – that potentially could make insurers happy, things like – insurers can refuse coverage to someone who hasn't paid all of their premiums until they've paid off all of their debts. They're going to shrink the special enrollment period. That's for people who are not signing up in the traditional time, maybe because mm-hmm. they had a death in the family or they got laid off or whatever, and giving insurers greater flexibility to determine the level of coverage in their plans. Mm-hmm. These are things that insurers have wanted and could help them shore up some costs and bring that predictability. But at the same time, Kai, these are also moves that, on the flip side, will make it harder for consumers to sign up. So that limits how many customers the insurers could have.
Yeah, it also sounds more corporate-friendly than consumer-friendly.
Absolutely. I've talked to a couple of sources this morning already who all agree. You're going to hear a lot of people who like the Affordable Care Act say this is the Trump administration undermining, or the word that people are starting to use is sabotage, the Affordable Care Act. And we have to remember this continues to be the law of the land. I mean, Republicans will probably come up with some kind of plan to repeal and replace. But this is making it harder for people to get coverage. There's no doubt about it. And insurers are in this weird position where they don't want to bleed money, but they also want to have as many customers as they can. So I think this is going to be treated from the industry perspective as a bit of a mixed bag.
Dan Gorenstein at the Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Kai.
Those who have more than a passing familiarity with the who's who of Wall Street are going to know the name Sally Krawcheck. She was the chief financial officer. She also ran wealth management at Citigroup until she got fired for trying to make customers who'd bought some of Citi's toxic assets during the financial crisis whole. She ran Merrill Lynch after Bank of America bought it. She got forced out there after a change at the top of B of A. So now she's doing it herself. She is the founder and CEO of an investment platform for women called Elevest, and she's out with a new book. Her first, it's called Own It, The Power of Women at Work. And she is today's conversation from the corner office. Sally Krawcheck, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to repeat you back to yourself here from the book about the middle of it or so. I was an investment banker in my 20s, a research analyst in my 30s, a manager of complex wealth management businesses in my 40s, and now I'm an entrepreneur in my 50s. That is, first of all, sorry. I didn't even think about it. I do apologize. But that's quite a track record in serious, heavy-duty capitalism.
Yeah, I've loved every minute of it, and I believe that is the type of career path we're going to see more of going forward, that it will not be the I started at XYZ company at 22 and then I retired with the gold watch at 65. Mm-hmm. one type of a career for decades is not going to happen going forward.
And also to the point of this book, though, that you believe now firmly that women will have, as you had, increasing roles of responsibility, and it will not be a rare thing.
I think that's right. Today we know that gender diversity leads to not just better business results, but substantially better business results. That, however, has not been enough to get women ahead. In fact, for all the conversation and debate we've had around diversity, we've been pretty stalled out. What is changing is the characteristics we women bring to business are going to be even more valuable. And also, if companies don't treat us well, we now have the information and power to take action.
This is the question in this interview where it will perhaps not be appropriate for everybody who's listening in the car or in the kitchen. It'll last about 45 seconds. So that's with that disclaimer. Here you know where I'm going with this, right? Here, you
know
where
I'm
going. You wrote this book.
I do know.
You do know.
I do know.
So
here we go. I know exactly where you're going.
You, since I've already given away your age, you started on Wall Street 30-something years ago. And you say that at the beginning of your career, it was literally an everyday occurrence for you to come into your desk and find on it a photocopy of male genitalia. And I asked that question because it's shocking on its face, but also because the producer who was preparing this interview for me came into my office a couple of days ago, said, "Can you believe this?" And she's, you know, a woman in her mid-20s who has no concept of what it was like for you and your peers.
Boys club. I mean, and not a boys club as we think of today of, oh, someone said something that was gender insensitive or unaware, but actively trying to get the women out. And I tell you, it's really interesting when there's a Xerox copy of male genitalia on your desk. It takes you a minute to realize what it is. What is this piece of, oh my gosh, look at that. And then how do you react? And I had somebody say to me recently, well, did you go to HR? I was 22. I didn't even know what HR meant. By the way, I needed the job. So I took it. I crumpled it up. I threw it away and said, these guys are not getting rid of me.
Are you heartened that a woman in a professional setting in her 20s is absolutely horrified by that?
Well, I think you have to be absolutely horrified.
But the idea that it's so foreign to her experience, right?
Yes and no. You know, it's funny because this summer was a real wake-up call for me. There was a New York Times op-ed called Bro Talk on Wall Street, in which it was indicated that actually the company at which I used to work, the kind of crude, crass discussions were occurring. And then, of course, we had the Trump-Billy Bush conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this stuff matters. You and I both know that you can't objectify somebody with one group of people in one room and then walk into another room with those same people and promote that individual. You've just really put that person down. And so I was a little disheartened that it hadn't come as far as I'd hoped.
Can't get Sally Krawcheck on the phone, a woman who was in the belly of the beast when the financial crisis happened, and ask you your sense of why it happened. You have some fully developed thoughts on that.
Oh, they're fully developed because I was there. And the conventional wisdom, evil geniuses perfectly foresaw what was going to happen, crooks, et cetera, drove the economy off a cliff. Yeah. Not what I saw. In fact, I saw people who believed that the subprime market was going to continue to grow. In fact, the research indicates that subprime bankers had worse personal real estate performance than the public at large. So they believed it. What I saw was groupthink. What I saw were individuals who were alike, therefore had the same experiences, and so didn't have a fulsome picture of what was going on. They had the false comfort of agreement.
That's a great line, the false comfort of agreement. What do you make then, given all of that, what do you make of the change in regulatory attitude now that there's been a change of administration, right? The president has made it clear, both by his hires and by his executive actions, that he wants less regulation and a more favorable environment for Wall Street.
I'm shocked.
Are you seriously?
I don't think that the individuals who voted for Trump believed that they were voting for the regulations for Wall Street to be rolled back. I don't believe that's what they wanted. I think he campaigned on a tougher stance to Wall Street, not a looser stance.
So what happens?
Well, history would indicate not much that's good. The banks have demonstrated again and again that they do not self-regulate well, that they'll return capital to shareholders. That means in general, they won't have enough capital to support their businesses. And while that may make the results appear good in a good market, too little capital in a bad market is a recipe for disaster.
The book by Sally Krawcheck is called Own It, The Power of Women at Work. She is the CEO of the investment firm or investment company. What do you call it? Investment what?
I call it an innovative digital investment platform.
Elevest is what it's called. Sally, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We talked a bit longer than that, Sally and I did. You can hear the rest of it on our Corner Office podcast. Get it wherever you can. This final note on the way out today, in which presidents, they're just like us. So a bunch of big retail CEOs went to the White House today to bend the president's ear about the rumored border adjustment tax that we've been telling you about. First of all, you know that awkward thing when you're in a big meeting and you have to go around the table introducing yourself because nobody really knows anybody? Happens at the White House, too.
You bears would eat with Best Buy?
I'm Bill Rhodes with AutoZone.
Brian Cornell with Target.
But also this, let's back that tape up just a little bit.
Brian Cornell with Target.
Stéphane Targé, right?
Thank you.
Targé, right? Come on, man. All right, we are out of here. The rally continues on Wall Street. The Dow up 107 points today, about a half percent. NASDAQ up 36.6%. The S&P 500 climbed 11 points, a half percent or so there. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.